Refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar, Refi Revival: Stay Ahead of the Curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely, data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for timely market analysis and expert commentary from Optimal Blue. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. All right. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for being with us here today on June the 23rd. A lot to talk about. And in the interest of keeping you all informed, you know, we're going to try to keep it really current in terms of events that are going on in the market and also some geopolitical subjects to tackle today. So great show. We'll do the market update here in a minute. We'll talk a bit about what's going on with the conflict unfolding in the Middle East up to today. And then later on, we're going to talk with Siver Suleiman, our CTO, about our hackathon that we had a couple weeks ago. So if you've ever wondered, what is a hackathon? Or how you could even have your own hackathon, stay tuned. We'll talk through that here in a few minutes. First, just in the way of data, the OBMMI is still 6.8. We've been there for like 5 months, so not a lot of news there. But we'll talk through what happened at the Fed meeting and some of the commentary that came after that later on with Alex and Jeff. Volume is still good. Still seeing, you know, volume kind of eerily high, even with rates at 6.8. We see volume above where it was on average in 2019 pre-pandemic. Even refi is pretty healthy. 20% of loans that we see locked right now in our pricing engine are refis. So in a little bit of interesting data there, not a whole lot of change other than we're still seeing a decent improvement in volume over last year, despite rates being close to 7%. All right, let's go talk with Alex and Jeff about what's going on in the market. Okay, gentlemen, a lot to tackle today. Where to begin? Alex, just in the way of data, last week, before we even get into the FOMC meeting, what happened last week?
Yeah, relatively quiet week as the third week of the month typically is. Jobless claims, I think, was probably the number one thing, at least I was keeping an eye on. It remained, you know, elevated but steady, floating just shy of 250K week over week. So we're definitely still seeing, you know, that weakening that we've been talking about in the labor market. But again, nothing. Once we're well north of 250, I think that's when we really want to be concerned. 250 is kind of that cutoff between, you know, a good and a bad market. More to see there week over week. It's nice we get that data point each week just to kind of keep our finger on the pulse of where the labor market's at, which I think is more and more as tariffs have kind of moved to the sidelines for the moment, is where people are keeping their eyes on and gauging the health of the economy.
Yeah, and that number, you know, for the longest time was around 200. So we are starting to see that consistently high, like you said, around 250. And that's going to be a leading indicator above, you know, the non-farm number that's going to be at least, you know, going to be roughly weeks old, right? And is more of a survey number versus an actual unemployment benefits data point.
But just like so many of these data points, it's like a slightly weak number, right? It's we still can't get into a full blown trend in one direction, right?
Yeah, still. I mean, the unemployment rate is still, you know, below 4.5, which is, you know, 4.5 being that cutoff that we would look for the Fed potentially acting based on data and cutting rates. Speaking of which, let's just get into it. There's been some rhetoric since Wednesday. Wednesday was kind of an uneventful Fed meeting. Everyone knew that rates were going to be held steady, but some of the language that came out was a little bit stirred the pot a little bit, I would say, with the administration, where the you know, Jerome Powell said, basically implicated the tariff drama in at least part of their decision-making process, right? Where typically the Fed's going to look straight at the data and they're going to say it's all going to be data-driven. And they're still saying that going forward, but they're kind of anticipating that the data may be impacted by tariffs. So maybe it's semantics, but they basically said what? They said that, you know, the effects of tariffs have yet to show themselves in the inflation data. So they're kind of acting a little bit more cautious moving forward and maybe leaning towards keeping rates where they are because they feel like they may see inflation reignite, even though it hasn't happened. I mean, inflation is tamer than it's been since before the pandemic, right?
I mean, I agree with Powell's sentiment that, you know, keep an eye on tariffs. But I also agree that we have yet to see any of it bleed through to the general economy, or more or less. You know, there's certain, I think, like certain radio products that have been impacted quite a bit. But by and large, you know, the average consumer really hasn't felt a pinch yet from tariffs. You know, long story short, they kept rates where they're at, right at 4.25%, 4.5%. And yeah, during his press conference, and maybe he hasn't said this directly from the podium before, but he's definitely said we're in wait and see mode. And as you said, Jim, he kind of deferred from the data, the backward looking data, and said, you know, we're looking at the next 3 months here, and cutting rates into that the next 3 months. He couldn't do that with good conscience.
Yeah, he also noted just first quarter GDP numbers distorted by front loading imports by businesses to get ahead of the tariffs. So there's still a lot of moving parts while we're kind of in the middle of all this analysis. So again, yeah, wait and see mode. And then he noted also the declining sentiment and uncertainty that households and businesses are noting, as well as kind of forward looking indicators.
Yeah. And in the days since, feels as if a couple of the members of the board have maybe hedged those bets. And again, I don't think anything Powell said was, you know, inflammatory, maybe, you know, a little bit different from the typical discourse you hear from that podium. But, you know, Waller and Bowman both came out Friday and Monday, respectively, and made comments that, oh, there's a chance we could cut rates at the next meeting in July. You know, market participants still aren't showing that. But, you know, I definitely saw some hedging of bets there.
Yeah, there's only maybe a 22% right now in the CME, a 22% chance that we get a cut in July. But that it ticked up a little bit, like you said, when Bowman and some of the other governors kind of backtracked a little bit and said, you know, if inflation still looks good in a month and a half, we're probably, you know, we're supportive of a cut. And then meanwhile, you know, again, maybe not directly aimed at the administration were Powell's comments, but there were some comments that came out of the administration that were relatively inflammatory. There was some name calling, and then even Bill Pulte stepped up and basically said that the Fed is doing the country a great disservice, I think was the quote, by not cutting rates. So you're kind of stuck. I'm kind of stuck, right? I mean, there's no data that says there's like, where's the fire, right? Why do we need to cut rates right now? I get that it would be nice for short-term rates to be lower. I think Bill Pulte specifically, you know, coming from a you know, home building background, coming from the real estate business closer to what we all do, is speaking around mortgage rates. But I think, as we know, and a lot of folks know, the Fed cutting rates doesn't necessarily mean we get better mortgage rates, right? In the short term, it may cause a little bit of a jump in MBS prices, which could cause rates to drop a little bit. But I think, you know, like we talked about last week, and we've talked about on this podcast ad nauseum, with all the debt being dumped onto the market right now by our government and others, and just in general, it's sort of unlikely, no matter what the Fed does, it's unlikely that mortgage rates are going to drop much in the short term unless we get some sort of extenuating circumstance, like a market dislocation, or if this war that's going on in the Middle East gets out of hand or something along those lines, right?
Yeah. You know, a few other things worth noting that Pulte commented on, right? Jerome Powell is trapping homeowners in low rate mortgages and choking off existing home sales, directly fueling the housing supply crisis. He must lower rates. We've talked about before the dynamic. It's been a while, but we talked about the dynamic of rates and affordability. And, you know, low rates last time probably exacerbated the affordability crisis, right, with a home price appreciation because of it. So it is hard to put all these things together and say that lower rates will help affordability, you know, certainly increase supply, but also increase demand. So, you know, what does that dynamic look like together? But, you know, I think just especially worth noting that Pulte was the most vocal critic within the administration last week, talking about this, focusing on the housing sector in particular.
I think he's doing his part, you know, for the administration. The administration broadly wants to see lower rates, as we've talked about, as Jim said ad nauseum on the podcast. You know, there's a lot of debt coming to market this year. The administration, beyond just the housing market, mortgage market, they're looking to see lower rates for refinancing activities of federal debt.
Right. Yeah. So we'll see. Yeah. The government would like lower rates for obvious, you know, for their own purposes, but also for the consumer. It would be better for everybody if rates were lower business wise, but it, you know, inflation's a real thing. Inflation, you know, lower rates don't mean a lot if you're, you know, inflation goes back to, you know, 4, 5, 6+% and people's, you know, savings starts to erode again and our money is worth less than it was last year. All right. Let's shift gears a little bit. I think everybody knows at this point, but there's a rapidly escalating issue in the Middle East where, you know, the Israelis bombed Iran. They took out some military officials, some scientists, some nuclear sites. And then the U.S. engaged in our own bombing campaign on Saturday and potentially obliterated those sites that were softened up by the Israeli army. And then now it's kind of a standstill. But an eerie standstill, right? The markets don't seem to be reacting very much other than oil, which you would expect, you know, potential disruptions there with, you know, over 100, I think it's 100 tankers a day running through the straits that run south of Iran. But otherwise, you know, stock market's pretty flat today. MBS is pretty flat. Not a big market reaction. So not a lot to talk about here in terms of, you know, what to expect in the mortgage industry, I suppose. But obviously a situation to keep an eye on. You know, I wouldn't expect, you know, sometimes when these things happen, you get a flight to safety, they call it, right? Or a flight to quality. And that tends to drop rates. You see treasuries booming, we do see
rates. Speaking of treasuries, we do see the 10-year down a little bit. We're down to 4.3. So probably a little bit more action there than other parts of the market right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the markets have responded as you'd expect them to, like you said, oil up, flight to safety, treasuries down. But I think it's the lack of how big those moves have been, how muted those moves have been that have kind of caught people off guard. Like you said, I agree. I think a lot of people are in very much so wait and see mode, see what, you know, how the Iranians respond to this, because they will have to at some point. It very much feels as if, you know, diplomacy is kind of something that's out the window at a certain point, at least a strike of some sort, even if it's just for pictures, has to be made at this point to protect, you know, the legitimacy of their regime. And, you know, speaking of the regime, I think, you know, that's still not out of the question on if we're interested in regime change. It seems like the administration officials themselves aren't even quite sure if they want to commit to that quite yet, and what that would mean. But I think regime change would quite obviously initiate, this would be a far broader conflict if that were to
happen. Yeah, I mean, we've seen what can happen. We've seen what's happened before in conflicts that we've been involved in and not been involved in when there's regime change or any sort of power vacuum, right? Which could certainly happen if you topple the government of a country as large as Iran, which is, you know, over 100 million people.
And as modern history in the 21st century should teach us, we should be cautious of what could fill that black hole.
Tread lightly.
Should you know. Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
Just going back to your point at the beginning of this, Alex, you think just the magnitude is, because the lower magnitude on all these moves is just nobody's surprised by anything at this point, or it's, you know, there's so much going on, it's hard to figure out what to focus on, or a little bit of all that.
Yeah. It's, I personally would have expected a greater magnitude. You know, Iran has been one of those countries that we've had issue with since, you know, 79, since the hostage crisis and the revolution. And this is the first time since 79 that there's actually been military conflict directly between the US and Iran. And so it feels a little bit anticlimactic, I guess you could say. But yeah, like I said, I'm not, you know, on these energy desks trading oil, but for whatever reason they think cooler heads will prevail, or whatever damage that will be done will be minimal.
Yeah. I mean, geopolitically it's a bad situation, right? But yeah, it does seem like the markets have kind of shrugged it off. And part of it is, you know, I believe that there's a general floor on rates right now because there's this the debt boom that we've talked about here. Like, even if there's a flight to quality, the yields are still going to have to be pretty attractive for folks to dump a bunch of money into bonds. And hopefully we get a little bit of a drop like we saw in treasuries. Maybe we get that in mortgages here in the short term. But right now we're still, you know, high sixes. And unless there's some big surprise, which it feels like there's almost has to be at some point, not to jinx it, but something to really freak people out, you might see a little bit of a dip in the short term. But long term, it just feels like rates still have an upward, there's upward pressure.
Yeah. And I know I called it a sidelined issue at the top of the show, but tariffs, we are 2 weeks away from that July 7th deadline when they need to have trade deals done. And last I checked, I believe we have a trade deal done with Israel and the UK.
Yes.
So there's still a lot of work on that front to be done. Don't let that slip from your mind and your outlook.
Yeah. More updates on that here in the next couple of podcasts for sure. Cause yeah, the clock is ticking. We're getting down to the wire. Anything coming out this week? A little bit of consumer sentiment and confidence.
Yep. Yeah. We got consumer confidence this Tuesday, so tomorrow, if you're listening to this on the day the podcast releases, and consumer sentiment on Friday. I'm a little more interested in consumer confidence this time around. Just when you look at the weightings and how they're conducting these surveys, consumer confidence emphasizes labor conditions a little bit more. And like I was talking about earlier with the jobless claims, you know, you could see that beginning to feed through to consumer confidence as folks, you know, reassess their labor conditions and how employed they currently are.
Right. All right. Looking forward to that. And then, yeah, next week's a short one. It's kind of hard to believe Independence Day is coming up a week from Friday.
Yep. We will be, we'll be getting early employment figures on that half day, July 3rd, and then head right into the long weekend.
Nice. Good. We'll update you all on that next week on Monday. All right. Let's wrap it up.
Beautiful.
Thanks fellas. Good conversation. Thanks. All right. As promised, welcome Sivir Suleiman, CTO of Optimal Blue, and whether he agrees with me or not, accomplished golfer, as you can see in the background there with a couple of his trophies. Welcome, Sivir. Thanks for being with us today. We want to talk a little bit with you about the hackathon. So Sivir runs all things software development for Optimal Blue. And 2 weeks ago, we had a hackathon at our headquarters in Plano, Texas. And I was honored to be one of the judges. So I was down there with another group of folks who judged it. And then we had a whole room of people, product people, dev folks, just folks that were interested in witnessing and being part of the hackathon. And I was just blown away by the quality of the ideas, the actual implementation. Because as you'll see here in a minute, when we explain what a hackathon actually is, there's actually like a product that gets partially built by a group of like the idea people and the product people and some actual developers. So anyhow, let's kick this thing off with just an overview of what is a hackathon, Sivir?
Yeah, a great question, Jim. And I have to say I think you were a fair judge. So you did a great job. Thank you for participating in that. A hackathon, I mean, there are multiple definitions of it. But for me, a hackathon is anytime you rally a group of people, normally technologists, to build something new or build something that you've always wanted to build and you just didn't have time. But you want to build something new in a short period of time. And most of the time using new technology. And we'll talk about some of the, like our first hackathon that we did, how we use some new tech. We use AI, and it's new hackathon where it was a little different. But that's how I look at, that's my definition of a hackathon.
Yeah, I think that's helpful for folks to understand when we say hackathon. What is it that exactly that we're talking about?
Are we actually hacking something? Are we trying to break into a bank? Or are we? But no, it's really
no illegal activity happening.
Yes, no illegal activity, but like definitely
exactly. Yeah, the hacking part comes from, you know, when you're trying new technologies, right? You're trying to do a, like you said, partially built product, so sort of a proof of concept, or what we call a POC. And you're trying to either learn new technology or you want to use this new tech that you've learned into building something new, or use it for something existing, an existing problem that you wanted to solve. But it usually involves doing something new, and that's where the hacking comes in. You don't kind of know what you're doing. You know what you're doing, but you don't know what you're doing, and you're trying to learn through the hackathon.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's like, you know, tip of the spear sort of development. You know, you're right on sort of the cutting edge of, you know, what the idea is, the technology you're using and things like that, which
exactly.
It was really cool. I mean, you know, Jim and I were both a part of it, and it was, you know, really cool for me to experience. And, you know, I helped coordinate some teams around some ideas and topics, and, you know, there's some really impressive work that was done overall. But Siever, how would you sort of describe the hackathon that we did? Like, you know, you did so much work orchestrating it, organizing sort of behind the scenes. What are your sort of thoughts or takeaways from the hackathon overall?
Without, you know, ruining any surprises of features that are going to come out soon, right? We want to just kind of what's the high level, you know, what was fun about it?
Of course. Yeah. So this recent one, I mean, the organization, anything you do at that scale really takes a lot of coordination. And we have a fantastic team, as you know. So every hackathon, you can have a different format, by the way. The format of this recent one is we decided to open it up to the entire company. And we said, okay, what ideas do we have? It could be a product. It could be a service. It could be an internal tool. It could be, like we mentioned, new technologies that we could use to improve an existing process. So we opened it up to all of Optimal Blue, and we had an amazing turnout response of over 50 ideas that came from just different functions, different skill sets of the organization, not just developers. Kevin had a few ideas himself, the product team, client services, and we looked at all those ideas and we had to go through, we couldn't be working on 50, you know, 54 ideas. So we had to screen them based on certain criteria. So we went through that effort and we selected a subset of those. And then we gave people really just 6 weeks to work on them. And part of this that was really fun is, and painful for some people at the same time, fun, is we had the idea owners, just like an NFL draft, go build your own teams, right? We have people enroll in participating and working in the hackathon. By the way, we had 123 people that ended up participating in the hackathon, working on projects in 16 teams. But building those teams, the team formation, while it was a little stressful for some, it was kind of fun. It was like an NFL draft. You kind of trade resources because we had a maximum limit of the number of people you can have on a team. Also, the maximum number of developers you can have on a team. I think what we also got out of it, not just the great ideas and the products that came out of it, but also people worked with team members that they didn't work with that closely before. And they got to experience kind of leadership at having to build your team and just working together on these new technologies or new ideas that people were just fascinated by. This sounds like a simple idea, but we never thought about implementing it. And now we have the time to actually spend on doing at least a proof of concept to move it forward.
I have to circle back to the team formation phase, because that was actually a really fun, like 24 hours, because it was basically Hunger Games rules. It was just like everybody out for themselves. And you're really just, you're selling everybody on the idea. You know, we need someone to play this role, someone to play this role within the team. And so it was really fun to sort of watch that come together. I think that was really fun for everyone who was part of that. As you mentioned, it sponsored some ideas and helped sort of organize some teams, which was a lot of fun.
So yeah, when we opened up the enrollment phase, we also asked people, what role do you want to play, to Kevin's point? So if you are a QA, a tester, you didn't have to be a tester in the hackathon. You could be a product manager. You could be the scrum master. You could even do development. So we opened it up so you can play different roles if you wanted to. And that's what, you know, Kevin was mentioning, is you kind of look at everybody who enrolled in your idea and say, okay, what role can they play? I could have a salesperson who participated that can do my presentations or validate the business idea, get data for it. So it was really fun to let people play different roles as well.
sure.
Yeah, that was great. I think just seeing this is my first one, by the way. I don't think I mentioned that. My first one that I participated in, and again, blown away by the ideas and the team formation. I thought was very interesting and cool. It was nice to see people get together on a team who had never worked with each other before, and maybe never even knew each other existed. Right? I mean, we're a big, fairly big company, 450-ish people. So we had people even from like my desk in Denver, DC, San Francisco. We had some folks that submitted ideas, and they ended up recruiting, a couple of developers and a couple of product people, and spending time together, kind of like we did in college, right? Building a business case, but then actually building software. That was the part that was really amazing to me. Was each presentation culminated with a demo of a thing like that actually worked, and a lot of it was super innovative to the point where it felt like we were even pushing some of the limits of what like AI is doing. For instance, there was a huge AI theme, as you might imagine, right? Like, how can we use AI to make our system better, to make our processes better, whether internal or external or for the client? And we seem to be pushing even what Microsoft is capable of right now. And I know we've had some interaction with them even during the hackathon process, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Microsoft. I mean, we have a very deep partnership with Microsoft, and throughout the 6-week period, as you mentioned, so just kind of the process, right? So we had 6 weeks of working on those ideas. That's after team formation, by the way. That's after the fun 24 hours that come
right
through. So we had 6 weeks of people working on these, doing, kind of following the normal Scrum ceremonies, but not, you didn't have full 6 weeks. We kind of gave them 1 day per week to work on it. But that culminated in a full two-day, we call it e-hackathon. Microsoft, our partners, brought in 15 cloud solution architects, because we had 16 teams. They had 15 cloud solution architects that were dedicated to each team, some overlap, of course, that we had these virtual breakout rooms using Teams, by the way, that when the team, with our development team and the QA team and the business analyst and sales team, everybody, those hackathon teams were working on their projects, they had Microsoft available in those breakout rooms so they could ask them questions. And we had a couple of machine learning ideas. We have some AI ideas that you mentioned. All of those we had Microsoft on. So very deep, amazing engagement from Microsoft. But honestly, some of these ideas we couldn't move forward without their help and partnership. But to your other point, when we asked Microsoft, how are we, like if you compared us to the industry or what they see, not our industry, what Microsoft sees in terms of utilization of AI and where we are with that, they said we're at the very top 5% of the utilization as far as how we've been taking advantage of some of these new tools, AI tools for not only in our products, but also for productivity as developer tools, and now kind of getting into the data part. So we're pretty excited about how we've been able to sort of keep up with the AI development. And by the way, for the record, we'll always be behind, right? As we speak, new technologies are being built, new tools are coming out in AI, so we'll never catch up. You just have to kind of look at the last sort of known, trusted version to use, because you don't want to experiment too much with that stuff. We're kind of just, at the forefront of being able to use some of these new technologies. And honestly, these hackathons have enabled us to be able to kind of prove out these technologies in a fun, kind of free fashion where you're not impacting products, you're not impacting production, but you're allowing the team, you're allowing everyone to experiment and have fun, which will also help us prove out these new tech.
I want to circle back to something you just said there, because I think that's really important. I think also just helpful for our audience to know, Microsoft, considering Optimal Blue as part of the top 5% of enterprises and how we're adopting the most advanced technology, consuming the latest tools and capabilities. And I think honestly, that speaks to, a lot of work, Siver, that you've done and on the tech team. And like you mentioned, we have this really deep partnership with Microsoft, and they're constantly coming out with new things. I think they're actually really well positioned, based on everything that I've seen to sort of take advantage and help, enterprises go through the next wave of AI enhancements and capabilities that are out there. Even when we were doing the hackathon, between when we started and when we finished, they were rolling out new, you know, AI capabilities and, you know, things within Copilot and this, that, and the other. So yeah, it's a really, really interesting space for us to be in right now, sort of this, you know, top 5% area of just understanding and adopting the latest technology, and also just how much is changing right now, even between the start of 2025, let's say, and where we are now, how different, you know, things are and how much is evolving. It's really fascinating.
It's incredible. I mean, it's new tech coming, you know, new patterns, right? I mean, it's not just the initial LLM, you know, the large language model that is being built, is all the tools that are built on top of it, and how, for example, Claude, you know, with Claude Sonnet, they have perfected, shouldn't say perfected, they have really modified, they built their own version of an LLM that focuses on developer productivity, on coding. So they we're seeing like these niche markets, if you will, are being built, which ultimately helps us, right? Helps the consumer, helps the user the of those tools. So for us, really, it's just making sure, A, we stay on track with what's out there just to help us. But also, you know, we utilize some of these, the new technology, the new AI tools or models, to continue to focus on not just to use AI, but also really what problems are we able to solve for our customers that you couldn't do without AI, right? So in our case, the way we've used generative AI have been in areas where we truly are able to add value to our products and our features, and add value to our customers who use our products. And that we will continue to do that. And we'll also continue to be speedy, but also cautious about not just use that new, you know, the new shiny object, the new shiny tool that came out. We always evaluate, right? We look at the risks. We look at, you know, what happens if we implement this new tool, what kind of risks of security of content that comes with it. And we'll continue to do it that way.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And, you know, as far as the hackathon goes, one of the biggest takeaways for me, which I thought, you know, sort of reinforced something that I've sort of come to appreciate, which is that good ideas can really come from anywhere and anybody. You know, anybody within an organization, whether you're in leadership or you're on the ground doing the work, whether you're in product or dev or, you know, supporting your customers or in QA or marketing or anywhere. Good ideas come from anywhere. And the value in the hackathon to me was, you know, all of these ideas came together, you know, everyone's competing, and we sort of have, you know, the wisdom of the crowd take over. And, you know, the best ideas bubble up to the top. You know, we just get new value from new, you know, areas of the company. And I think that's really speaks to the folks at Optimal Blue who are passionate about the work that they do, who are coming in every day and trying to add value and what it is that they're doing and add value for our customers. You know, again, good ideas can come from anywhere. And I think that's something that's a big takeaway for me from the hackathon.
Yeah, let's use that as a segue, right? So we don't want to spoil any surprises, but just high level, right? I mean, some of the ideas that I recall are some of what the themes were, you know, is everywhere from automating some internal processes like coding, QA, writing queries, by the way, like one of the, this idea came from an engineer. My favorite name, it was a great idea, but my favorite name for the feature was called Querious George. So I'll just leave that there. And then we had, like I said, some folks from the desk who came up with some really good ideas around pull through. You might imagine some things that could be invented there, and, you know, through machine learning and AI. And I don't know; those are a couple of the ideas that stuck in my head. What did you guys, you know, what are some ideas that you really liked, and some of the people that came up with them?
Yeah, Jim, what I really loved about it is kind of what you said. I mean, it was like if you look at a spectrum of what the ideas spectrum looked like, right? We had ideas that were internal tools of how you would improve a very sort of, you know, tedious process or project that you have, all the way to building a brand new product that is evolutionary and revolutionary. It went from like a simple, very practical, actually, you know, value add idea to improve a process using technology, using AI, all the way to creating something, you know, big and new. And then in the middle was kind of, you know, product features, you know, things that you can do to existing products or processes for our tech team, like you mentioned in the QA organization or tech ops organization. How do we use some of these new tools? So it was a blend of everything, but it was just the way the presentations were made, made me, I was honestly, I mean, I didn't, by the way, for the record, I did not see any of the presentations until that last day, the last 2 days that we did. So I was personally also blown away by the quality of how they took those ideas and really made them work, but they, the way they presented them as well.
Agreed.
Those are some good takeaways. And one idea that sort of stuck with me, and I'll share this one since it's pretty generic in terms of, you know, what it's trying to solve. And it's something that we all know that AI can solve, which is, you know, we all have subject matter experts in our organizations who just, they, you know a lot of things. They just know everything, you know, the photographic memory type folks, right? We all know who they are. And the idea is how can we best scale those subject matter experts' resources across the company, their knowledge base across the company. You know, this is something that, again, if you're familiar with the capabilities of AI, you know that there's a potential to solve this. But the format of how that ends up happening was something that, you know, sat in on a lot of the debates. You know, is it going to be like, you know, like an AI agent where you go and interact and it's like you're talking to the subject matter expert and then, you know, it's coming back? Or is it going to be more of like you're going to compile their subject matter expertise and everyone else's, and then it just goes into this organizational, you know, repository and you just ask your questions and get the response back? There are all these different formats in which the problem could be solved, right? But one of those is going to ultimately win out over the other ones. And, you know, there's all sorts of tricky things. Like you want to make sure that the private messages don't get incorporated into this repository, you know, like, you know, of respecting privacy and things like that. It does seem like this is something that is also on Microsoft's radar too. So I wouldn't be super surprised if we end up seeing something more standardized that comes out maybe later this year that helps, you know, attack this problem in a more concrete way beyond sort of just the Copilot capabilities and things like that. But that was a really interesting one for me because it's really like there's still so many avenues where this could end up. And we just sort of need to, you know, keep playing with things to see where, you know, which format ultimately wins out.
You're right. And I think you're spot on about, you know, what Microsoft is going to do next. They're already kind of, you know, with Copilot and how the, you know, Office 365 Copilot and how it can be your assistant for all of your office, you know, whether it's Outlook, Word, Excel, et cetera. So I think you're spot on, Kevin, that a lot of these, you know, honestly, there are ideas that we had that were submitted. We looked at it. They were fantastic ideas, but we thought they shouldn't, they didn't make it to the working stage, if you will. And, you know, we found out a month later, Microsoft, you know, came out with a tool like it. So it just, the new tech is going to continue to come up and rise. And we just have to kind of be on the lookout for all of that.
Tons of good ideas. I'd say, you know, as teasers, we've put a bunch of them out there, but for customers, I'd say, you know, customer facing, I would say expect more features that, you know, make your life easier, make some of the more complicated parts of this industry or our systems a lot simpler to communicate with and kind of help you accomplish what you're trying to do, but also just some innovative stuff that's just going to, you know, continue to push the ball forward in terms of what any, you know, Optimal Blue or any type of system in our industry is capable of.
Exactly. And I will just say one other thing about the hackathon wasn't just AI, right? So we opened it up to any type of idea, and that's what we did. But just on the, you know, Kevin, what you mentioned about ideas can come from everyone. I've always had, I had the belief of that ideas can come from anyone, of course, and ideas is just a start, right? What really matters after that is the execution and how you actually execute and build on top of that idea. And that's what we did. We didn't just get the ideas from everyone. During the hackathon, we also built those. And if you remember, last year, we did a hackathon, which was a little different format. We had very specific ideas that came from our product team and operations team as well. And we had a proof of using AI for those ideas. And as you know, three of those six made it to our summit last year. So we executed not only during the hackathon, but also during our normal product development process. So we pride ourselves, you know, collectively, as you know, as in our execution on ideas to build those features of those products for our customers. And that's really what it matters, right? When you actually deliver and produce a working product for the customers.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point, because it's you can't have one without the other. You can't have good idea and poor execution, and also, you know, execution without the, you know, the good idea to start with. You really need kind of excellence in both of those areas to really do something transformative. And I do think that, you know, the teams that worked on the hackathon really hit both of those really well. So I think it's a great point.
Solid problem solving. That's what it takes, right? Just to execute on those ideas. You can't just have a great idea. You have to figure out how to actually articulate it, explain it to your team, and get it done. All right, gentlemen, did we miss anything?
I don't think so. I think that was a pretty thorough overview. But yeah, really, you know, thought it would be great to just have more of a behind the scenes look, kind of how everything came together, how it all worked, and, you know, what are some of the snippets that came out of it. So thought that was a good conversation.
Yeah. Hopefully this is helpful to folks out there. I'd say no matter what, you know, no matter the size of your business, this is the kind of thing you could do anywhere. You don't have to be a software business, honestly. Every business has their needs, and everybody has these ideas, and this lets you get them out in the open. And so, I'd say I would encourage everyone out there to look into this sort of thing and get it done. We're certainly going to do it again. This won't be the last hackathon that we do.
100%. Next time is going to be a different format. We actually just sent out a survey for our team who participated to get feedback. And, you know, what should the format of this one wasn't my idea. It was ideas from a couple of people who thought, you know, let's do this different from the first time, right? So it could be any format. And like you said, Jim, it does not have to be, you know, AI. It doesn't have to be just tech. You don't have to be a big company. Just do a hackathon and just get ideas. Really, it's just, you know, proving out new methods, proving out new concepts that you want to just experiment with.
Great. Good advice. All right, gentlemen. Great conversation. Seaver, appreciate you being a guest. Kevin, as always, thanks for being here, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining today. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Seaver. And Kevin. Great conversations, great interviews, good market update. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thank you for tuning in to Optimal Insights.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.